Twilight by Tuesday Love Sang Grandpa. Read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 6. Conditions had been very trying of late. There had been a terrible influx of letters, sometimes well over 100 letters each day, and people got so irritated if they had to wait a day or two for a reply. The pains had been increasing, and the general type of weather had been making me feel worse and worse. Night after night, I tossed restlessly in my hospital bed at home, and at last one night I couldn't stand it any longer. Mrs. Rampa nearly burned out the telephone lines, trying to find a doctor who would do a house call. One awful woman doctor was most discourteous and most inhumane. "Take him off to the hospital," she said. "It's the only thing to do with people like that." Well, my wife phoned around place after place, but no doctor was willing to do a house call. I passed the night in truly considerable agony, wondering whatever had happened to the medical profession. Surely the medical profession was dedicated to the relief of suffering? Surely one of the elementary precepts was do no harm? It was indeed doing me harm, leaving me in my state of suffering. But for that night, there was to be no relief and no ease. The dismal hours wore on, and all through the night the traffic roared by my window. One of the remarkable things about Calgary is that traffic continues unabated throughout the 24 hours. It seems that the traffic never ceases, but that is to be expected of a city which has the greatest number of cars to the population in North America. At last, the first dim glimmerings of light began to filter in my window, and then, once again, there was the effort to try and find a doctor who would do a house call. Some of you may wonder why I wasn't rushed off to the hospital, and the answer to that is simple. Hospitals nowadays do not like to take a patient unless there is a definite order or committal from a general practitioner. There have been so many cases reported lately of patients being turned away from hospitals. In fact, just about the time of my increasing illness, a case had been reported of a person who had been taken to the hospital and who had been refused. The poor, wretched sufferer had been taken to a number of hospitals and refused from each one, and then he died at home. At the inquest, it all came out, but because I was ill at the time, I rather lost track of what happened, although I believe the whole thing was hushed up by the hospital authorities. At about midday, we were successful in getting a doctor call upon me. He came, he looked, and he phoned the ambulance. In about 20 minutes the ambulance men came, and very smart, very efficient young men they were. They were the most considerate ambulance men I've had, and I've been in hospitals in England, Germany, France, Russia, and a few other places. But these young men really knew their job. They got me on their mobile stretcher and got me out that door, and then one of them said proudly, "You're only the second patient to ride in this ambulance. It's only been delivered to us today." Yes, and a nice ambulance it was, too. My stretcher was slid inside, one of the attendants got in with me, and off we drove to the Foothills Hospital. Soon we were rolling along the new road leading to the hospital. Soon after, there was a sudden darkening as we entered the ambulance bay. Without any red tape, without any lost time, my stretcher was slid out and onto the wheel trolley again, and the two ambulance men pushed me through corridors and into an elevator. Smoothly, the elevator moved upwards and came to a stop without a jerk. I was maneuvered most carefully down another corridor and into a ward, and I must again say that these two young men knew their job. They were efficient, they were gentle, so different from some others from whom I have suffered. The Foothills Hospital is perhaps the best hospital in Calgary, the most efficient, the most modern. It is a warm place where people care, and I must say that the time I spent there was as pleasant as the nurses and orderlies could make it. No one is going to be so foolish as to say that the treatment is pleasant. It is, as I said to the income tax people when they tried to query why I should have a wheelchair. Well, surely one doesn't have a wheelchair for pleasure. It's a matter of necessity for the disabled. And in the same way, the treatment in the hospital was not enjoyable, but it was made as painless as possible by the care and the devotion of the medical staff. At other hospitals, there has been absolutely no human thought. But for the Foothills Hospital, I was so impressed that when I left, I wrote to the medical director and administrator specifically praising certain nurses and a certain orderly. An orderly who really did go beyond the limit of his strict duty to make things easier for sufferers. Naturally enough, I hope I never go in to the Foothills Hospital again, but undoubtedly I shall have to go to a hospital, and my choice, without any reservations, would be that one again, the Foothills Hospital of Calgary, about the best hospital that one can meet, if one does meet a hospital. But home again, not cured, naturally. I was feeling quite ill, and the work on this book is hard going. Hard going because when one has had much suffering, as I have had, then the body rebels at extra work. Never mind, I have said that this book will be written, and it will be written. Today, I've been out again for the second time since I came home from the hospital. Biggs is still here, and will be here for about a week more. We went up into the foothills, and once again, I discovered the disadvantages of being a sensitive, because we passed an old Indian encampment, the scene of a massacre, and the worst I am in health, the more psychic I become, and at one stage I had to close my eyes because I could see the Indians and the battle raging. It was so vivid that it was to me as plain as the car in which I sat, and it is a frightening thing to go driving through a massacre. Even Biggs, the driver, not claiming to be a sensitive, could still feel something as if his hair was standing on end. It was very pleasant, though, up in the higher ground, looking out across the city. But, like so many other cities nowadays, the atmosphere is polluted. We have oil wells all around Calgary, and they spew fumes into the air day and night. In my ignorance, I always marvel that the fumes lie around the city. We are at 3,500 feet above sea level, the highest city in Canada, and I rather wondered why the fumes didn't go rolling down to the prairies. Never mind, one day perhaps I shall know the reason. But it is disheartening to look out and to see this ring of brown fog all around the city. Back from my tour into the foothills, work again, because the work must go on no matter what. Before we go on answering the type of questions in which you are most interested, let me answer a question which is very frequently put to me. I just don't understand this address of yours, BM/TLR, London, England. Doesn't seem much of an address to me. People do not believe that that is a proper address, and so they engage in all manner of strange devices to make sure that the post office authorities in England know that the letter is meant for me. So I'm going to take a little space to give a free advertisement to a very fine firm. Many, many years ago, a man in England decided that it would be a wonderful convenience for travelers and others who did not want their address commonly known to have an arrangement with the British Post Office, whereby he could have a general address, which was British Mono Marks, London, WC1, and any correspondence bearing the BM would be sent to a firm which he organized. Then, for a very modest sum, he provided people with what are called monomark addresses. The cheapest type are those which are allotted to one, which could be, by way of example, BM/1234. But if you want to use your own initials, you could do as I have done. My monomark is BM/TLR. Now, the BM stands for British Monomarks, and when the post office sorters see the BM, they know it is for British Monomarks, and of course, the letter is then delivered to British Monomarks. British Monomarks know that the BM is their bit, and so they go by the second bit, TLR, in this case. So they put TLR mail in a box, and about two or three times a week, the mail is sent on to me, either by having sticky labels stuck over the BM bit, or by being packed in a big envelope. It depends on what one wants. There is another type of BM monomark too, but that is a BCM, and that is for firms. It means a commercial monomark. Mine is a private type, but if I was a big firm, I would have a British commercial monomark. In 20 years, I have not had a single complaint against British monomarks, and it is truly a matter of complete amazement to me how carefully they deal with the mail and how infallible they are. Just think, I get a vast amount of mail from all over the world, even from Moscow. And monomarks don't pinch the foreign stamps off the envelopes, and they don't make any mistakes either. So if you want to find out more about them, all you have to do is write to BCM/Mono, London, WC1, England, and they will give you all the information you need. but I want to take this opportunity to most sincerely congratulating the Monomark firm for their absolutely wonderful service they give. Take my own case, I move about. I've been to other countries and I've been all around Canada, and yet all I have to do is to write to Monomarks and tell them that as from such and such a date, please forward all my mail to my new address, and without any mistakes whatever, the mail arrives. Let me tell you this, it's worth telling or worth reading. A little time ago there was a most unfortunate occurrence. A lady of my acquaintance, a friend of mine, had a little nerve trouble, and I suppose she was worried about the troubles I was having with the press. So she wrote to British Monomarks and told them to send all my mail to her address. She made it appear that it was a definite request from me. British Monomarks are truly an experienced firm. They did not take her at her word. They were not deluded. They wrote to me to see what my instructions were. Well, I nearly blew a fuse. But then I calmed down and realized that you don't just throw over a friend for a little mistake caused perhaps by nerve strain. So I told Monomarks to send my mail on to me as before. Really, I cannot praise them too highly. You may think I'm going overboard about them, but that's not so at all. One's mail is important, and it is vital to all of us that we can absolutely depend on those who forward our mail. You can depend on Monomarks. So, thank you, ladies and gentlemen of the Monomark staff. Mrs. Rouse, alias Buttercup, tells me I look like Doc of the Seven Dwarfs when I'm getting ready for work. Well, I'm not so sure she doesn't really mean dopey, but anyway, I suppose I do look a queer old fellow stuck in a wheelchair surrounded by masses of letters containing even more masses of questions. Never mind. I've been asked to write this book, and I'm writing the thing in spite of feeling like something the cat brought in and left behind in a hurry. So, let's get on with our questions and answers, shall we? Oh, glory be, oh, glory be, I've let myself in for something now. Here's the first question, which I have just picked up. So you'd better sit back and polish up your glasses, if you wear the things, and get a load of this. Considering we are three-dimensional beings, evolving hopefully into the fourth dimension, it follows, logically, that we came from a second dimension, and before that, a first. My first question is this digression true? And if so, what were we before the first dimension, and what spiritual attainment did we need to advance? And now to further complicate things, if the first and second do not exist in our evolution, as we theorized before, then where do we originate from before the third dimension? Now, I hope your head is not going around as much as mine is, because actually, this is true enough, you know. We do evolve from a one-dimensional being. Consider, for example, an amoeba. You could logically, I suppose, consider the lowly amoeba as being a one-dimensional creature, and all life evolves from a single-celled entity, and the single cell grows other cells, and then eventually fission occurs to make two or more entities. That is the earliest stage of evolution. But anyway, actually, this is not a question that we can answer satisfactorily, because the one-dimensional creature would have no more understanding of our third-dimensional world than a person can have of the sixth-dimensional world while here. So, we have to take certain things on trust. There are some people who really blind themselves with science, as the saying is. They try to formulate questions beyond their own understanding. So, we do evolve from a one-dimensional entity right up to the uncountable, unmentionable dimensions until at last we become one with the Overself. And then, when we are one with the Overself is complete. And then it too has to go on to further evolution. You cannot have things stationary in any form of nature. Nothing is stationary. You can't stand still on a tightrope, for instance. If you try to, you've got to keep on wobbling or swaying in order to maintain your apparently stationary posture. And if you are wobbling, you're not stationary, are you? So, all life is movement. All life is vibration. And the more we evolve, the more vibrations we set in motion. Would it help at all if I say to the musicians, we can have one simple note, middle C, if you like. And that's the only one I know. Then you can take that as being a one-dimensional being. But then, when you progress so that you can use two hands on your piano and you can play a multiple chord, you can say that you are now up to three or four or five dimensions in terms of vibration, because whether we like it or not, music, no matter how beautiful, is still just a collection of vibrations which get on with each other. I'm sorry I can't answer that more specifically, but you would not teach newborn babies calculus, would you? Now, here's a question which is sure to get me in trouble. Some people write and tell me that I am opposed to Jews. Believe me, that is definitely not the case. I get on extremely well with Jewish people. I suppose as a Buddhist I have some sympathy with them. Most of them certainly have sympathy with me. You have said that Jewish people are a group who were kept back to try it again in this round of existence. Does this mean that Jewish people are always Jews throughout their lives on earth? No, it doesn't mean that at all. Let's forget about Jews and Christians and Buddhists and let's have a look at school. All right, here we are in school. We've got a bunch of grade 2 hoodlums and they have reached the end of the term. Now they're being put through their paces by way of examinations to see if their stupid brains have absorbed any knowledge during the past term. Some of them can pass the examinations, probably through good fortune more than anything else, but anyway, the ones who pass go on up to grade 3. The poor wretches who do not pass get kept in grade 2. Now, when they are in grade 2 for the second time, they feel inferior and superior at the same time. They feel inferior in that they were not brainy enough to pass the examinations and get promoted. But they feel superior to the new crowd who have come into grade 2. And so sometimes they act in a most unbearable manner. You feel it would be a pleasure to take a cane and tan their backsides until they turned into leather. Jews are people who, on another round of existence or another cycle of existence, call it what you will, did not pass the end of term examinations, so they have been kept back in this particular class for another go, and some of them feel arrogant, some of them feel inferior, but the rest of the people resent the Jews because they have so much more innate knowledge. I get on with Jews very well. I understand them. They understand me. And no Jew has ever tried to convert me to anything. Gentiles have. Sometimes stupid old biddies with a touch of religious mania make life a misery by sending me tracts and pamphlets, Bibles, good words and verse, and they get worse and worse and all the rest. Sometimes they will send me ornamental crucifixes or pictures which I'm supposed to hang up all around me. Well, all the junk of that sort goes into the garbage. I don't need anyone to tell me what my religion is going to be. I have one, even though I am a Buddhist. I have my own private beliefs. Buddhism is just a way of life. Anyway, Jews are nearly always far better behaved than Christians, aren't they? Look at Jewish children, how well they're disciplined. Look at Jewish adults. If they are treated properly, they are fine people. And I am proud to number certain wonderful Jewish people as my friends. There weren't any Jews before Abraham, anyway, or they weren't called Jews before that. Before that, they had a completely different classification. One might say the G.I. Joe suddenly became Joe Doakes. It's just a case of being a Rose by any other name. So a short answer would be that a person is not necessarily a Jew after this particular cycle, because after he has learned his lessons, he will be promoted to the next class where, hopefully, there won't even be Christians. Look at it like this. In school, a second grader is one who couldn't pass his examinations, but if at the next examinations he does pass, then he might be promoted to a third grade. One lady is having trouble, it seems. She wants to know, is there herbal birth control that you know of? Is there any form you would recommend that is practiced now? I have never set up as a birth control specialist. And, of course, people in Far Eastern countries use only herbs to control conception. And these herbs are infallible. But what is the point, madam, of telling you about them if you can't go out and get them? And you can't. So I think the kindest advice I can give you, if you feel that way, you better go along to your local birth control clinic and get their advice. Oh, dear me, some people get really nasty at times, don't they? I've got a gentleman here who tells me in the most vicious way possible that I am out to make a fast buck writing books, and if I were in any way genuine, I would see that a special index was prepared so that he wouldn't have the trouble, he, mind you, of looking through all my books to find out something hidden in a mass of stupid words. Well, of course, I would like to have an index, but no one else seems to want it. I would like, in fact, to have a separate book, such as, for example, a 16th book, and the 16th book be nothing but an index. All right, then. Would you readers be prepared to pay for a book which is nothing but an index? If so, write and tell my publisher. You will find the address in this book. He won't provide it free, that's certain, because he, too, has to make a living. Anyway, if people read my books properly, they should have an adequate knowledge of what is in them. Did I tell you I had had a letter from a woman in California, and she told me that she had read You Forever in half an hour, and if I was anything of a writer, I would have put all the meat of the book in half a chapter. I am still marveling that a person can read a book such as You Forever in half an hour. Still marveling, and still disbelieving. A gentleman in France seems to be very worried about his future, and this is his actual letter. Perhaps I have evil, but my question to you, they seem to have provoked you a little paradoxical answers, opposite which you in your books express. Far be it from me to address a reproach to you, but on the contrary, a fervent desire for will to understand you. You say in your letter that the Mediterranean will be quite safe. On the other hand, I believe to remember that in the one of your books you speak of submersion for the periphery of the sea. Well, I still say I am right. The Mediterranean will eventually have the seabed rise so that what is now water will become land. I told this inquirer in a letter that he would be quite safe, and I still say that he will be quite safe from such a disaster. You see, people think of their own lifetime, and they think that that is all eternity, but it isn't. If a catastrophe is going to happen in perhaps 100 years, then a person who might have perhaps 20 years of life left is quite safe from that disaster. People write to me and ask if they should flee to the Rockies or they should go somewhere else, and they get quite offensive when I tell them that, in my opinion, they will be quite safe where they are. Think of an old fellow of 70 writing to me in a horrible state of fright because he thinks the land is going to sink and he is going to get the top of his head wet. I say that where the man lives, there will be submergence in the years to come, but I do not think that there will be a submergence in his lifetime. If you are thinking of your grandsons, okay, move out fast. Move into the Rockies, the Canadian Rockies, of course. You'll have to do a lot of snow clearing first, because as I am writing this book, I can look out and see the Rockies, and there's really a pile of snow at the top. But seriously, the average person who writes in doesn't have to worry. These disasters won't be in your lifetime, unless You are writing on behalf of a small child. Hello, Sheila McMoran. So, you have decided to send me some questions, have you? You ask me, what must one do to be able to communicate with nature spirits or fairies? That's easy enough. You have to live what is called a pure life in order that your vibrations are increased. You have to live as a hermit or hermitess, because if you mix with a lot of people, your personal vibrations will be slowed down. Otherwise, you won't be able to get on with other people. Then, you'll have to practice telepathy, because it's no good speaking to nature spirits in vocal words. The vocal system of speech is too crude, too gross for nature spirits. All you can use is telepathy. But if you can communicate with your cat, then you can communicate with nature spirits. You also write, people cast about looking for salvation and enlightenment. Could it be that the answers we seek lie not in any outside source, but only within us? Oh, yes, definitely. We are what we make ourselves. If we believe in a thing, then that thing can be. And I would say that by far the easiest method of finding salvation is to obey the golden rule. Do only unto others as you would have them do unto you. So many people think that they're going to get salvation in some holy book or by following some teachings, which is thousands of years out of date. If you're going to follow some of these early Christian beliefs, then you will have to agree that women are inferior articles, chattels. But our women's libbers wouldn't like that, and of course they are right. My own belief is, should I whisper this? Women are in every way the equal of men, but they are different creatures, almost a different species. Men are suitable for some things, and women are suitable for others. So, why don't women do their particular task and look after the nation, look after the discipline and the training of the forthcoming race? They would find they would get salvation that way. Humbleness, sincerity, harmlessness, forgiveness, uprightness, devotion to the spiritual master, purity, steadiness, self-harmony. If a person is trying to live these precepts, could he, or pardon me, also she, have faith that he is progressing rightly, even though no visions are seen and no occult powers are made manifest? Definitely, because if you are obeying the golden rule, then you will be on the way to getting all these abilities, and there is nothing holy in being psychic. There's nothing particularly spiritual in being clairvoyant. It's just an ability. For example, you wouldn't say that a person is necessarily spiritual because she can sing or paint or write books. They are abilities. Spirituality has nothing to do with it, so it doesn't matter how pure or holy or upright a person may be. If he or she does not have the necessary physical makeup to be psychic, then he or she won't be psychic. You can be psychic even if you are bad. but it's better to be psychic and good. Now Sheila McMoran has a question here, which applies to a lot of people. A lot of people have written similar types of things, so here's the complete question. It has been said by you and other wise men that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. It has also been said that for one to progress on the path and awaken the latent divinity within oneself, one must have a teacher. How best may one prepare for the meeting with a spiritual teacher? Can this meeting take place in any walk of life, or must certain things be done or given up before it can take place? Would it be true that one might prepare now for a meeting to take place in some future life? Yes, it is perfectly true that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And it is not for the student to say, when he or she is ready. What happens is this. As the aspiring student develops, he or she increases in basic vibration. That vibration is like a bell sounding in the etheric. So a teacher who is always ready for a student, and who may appear in the physical or who may not, goes to the aid of a student. And I want to make it clear that it doesn't necessarily mean that the teacher is going to sit opposite the student and rap him over the knuckles every so often to secure his attention. The teacher may be in the astral and may teach the student when the student also is in the astral. So many people write and insist that they are ready. They are quite positive that they are ready. So why do not I or someone else rush over land and sea to their assistance? I dispute that people should have physical teachers. I am definitely opposed to all these correspondence courses alleging to teach one metaphysics, spirituality, etc., etc. If you need a teacher, you will get one in the astral, and I'm going to tell you this. When you die, that is, when your physical body is finished with this earth, and your astral entity goes on to the astral world, it has to stand alone and answer for successes and failures. And it is useless to think that because you once took a correspondence course in bootlicking, that the chief bootlicker is going to come and speak on your behalf, explaining why you can only lick black boots and not brown boots. No. When you pass over, you have to stand alone and answer to yourself alone. So the best thing to do is to get used to it now. Rely on yourself. Rely on your own resources. You don't want to be just a slave or a shadow of some correspondence course or some stupid cult leader, do you? You are an entity, so act as one. You ask Sheila McMoran if certain things have to be given up before one can advance. And the answer is, of course, yes. You have to give up things like intoxicants because they can affect your psyche. You have to give up drugs. Not you, of course, because you don't have any of these things. Perhaps I should have said one must give up these things. One must give up the things which harm the astral body, because if you're harming the astral body, then all your vibrations are wrong, aren't they? And if your vibrations are wrong, you will not get an astral or physical teacher. So you're right back where you started from. Throughout the ages, initiation has played a vital role in the progress of the soul. In the present age, how and under what circumstances may this initiation take place? Well, I'm not much in favor of initiations, because usually it's just a mumbo-jumbo ceremony, which doesn't mean a thing except to scare some poor wretch half out of his life. All you need, really, is a simple, straightforward affirmation, a statement of intent, a promise that one is going to do certain things or study certain things, and I maintain that it is just plain stupid to dunk a person in dirty water or give him a swig of wine or put bits of colored cloth on him. That merely is a theatrical act of mumbo-jumbo. A simple affirmation is all that is necessary as an initiation ceremony. It is merely an understanding that a person is ready to take certain steps which will increase his psychic ability. Jesus and other world leaders had followers and friends other than their immediate disciples. You have said in Chapters of Life that a new world leader is to be born in 1985. Would it be possible for a person to do anything now to be worthy of becoming a helper, a supporter, follower, or friend to the new world leader in that future time? Or will those close followers all be on a different cycle from the rest of us? The only way that one can prepare is by living a decent life, a spiritual life, a correct life, and so setting an example to those around you. Nowadays, we live in a truly horrid age where everybody is trying to beat down everyone else, and things are going to get much worse unless enough of us make sure that we are examples of the benefits that can be derived by leading a decent life. Most people will only do a thing if there's some material gain for them. That sounds shockingly cynical, I know, but I believe it to be a fact, and so at the outset, at least, one has to show others that there are material benefits from calmness, peacefulness, and honesty. And until the opposition can be convinced of those benefits, then they will not follow the straight and narrow path. End of chapter 6.